Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast, where we explore the pivotal questions shaping the future of healthcare. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Thomas, your host and a partner in the Pharma Life Sciences practice at Strategy End, which is PwC's global strategy consulting business. Today's episode comes to you from wintry London, and I'm excited to delve into a new area that we have not yet covered. InsurTech, which is a specialized subsector of fintech that is focused on the innovative application of technology in the insurance industry. And with me to discuss the potential of InsurTech for the future of health is Ambra Zhang, who is the co-founder and CEO of Uniper, which is a promising new startup from the UK that provides comprehensive reproductive healthcare insurance. The startup itself provides coverage for disease diagnosis and treatment, as well as family planning services ranging from gynecological and urological consultations, menopause, but also low testosterone management to alternative family building options. Ambra herself was born in Italy to Chinese parents and moved into the UK to pursue a bachelor's degree in international management at Warwick University. She began her career in London as an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and later became a tech and financial services investor at a private equity firm. Motivated by her personal struggles and the evident gap in healthcare coverage that I'm sure we'll discuss later, Ambra took the bold step to start her own business with Juniper. Really, I'm thrilled to learn more about this innovative insurance approach from her. And thank you, first of all, Ambra, for being with us today, inviting us here. Really big thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me, Thomas. It's a pleasure to be on this podcast.
Cool. Hey, you built Juniper really from the ground up when you were in your early 20s with only a few years of work experience under your personal belt. Can you share more about how your personal kind of story influenced this journey and what actually motivated you to take such a significant endeavor at really such a young age?
Of course. I mean, it's a very loaded question
start
with, but I think my personal story is twofold here. And the first part, it's very much my family history. Mm-hmm. I come from parents who are Chinese, who moved to Italy 30 years ago or more, and they really started from nothing. Mm-hmm. So they started working at Chinese takeaways, Chinese restaurants as waiters and cooks, and they had to make a living. Mm-hmm. They had that Italian dream, the same way you have the American dream. And over time, they realized, well, we need to do something. We need mm-hmm. to build our own business. So they opened their own Chinese restaurant. Mm-hmm. That's when I was born. I grew up until I was six, running around that Chinese restaurant all the time. And I remember putting the chopsticks on the table really as a game. But I saw my parents really working hard. Mm-hmm. And when I was six, one day, my dad came to the restaurant with a massive van. And that was the start of Mulan, which is the business that they built after. Mm-hmm. They realized that the restaurant business couldn't scale. It's very, very long hours. You need to be there all the time. And they actually started producing, like, actually cooking in the kitchen, massive batches of food to sell into grocery stores. Mm-hmm. And that's what Mulan Group is. It's ready-to-go meals sold in grocery stores in Italy and in Europe now. And so after I was six, I started helping them, whether it was putting stickers on the little packages all the way to packing the prawn crackers mm-hmm. to helping doing some spring rolls as well mm-hmm. during my summers. And I really enjoyed it. I didn't see it as hard work, but I was always very inspired by my parents all the way until later when it was about how can you help Ambra as you know Italian, you are going to school. And that's when every dinner table conversation became a case study, mm-hmm. essentially. Mm-hmm. And we're always talking about business. We're always talking about how can we grow this further. And I really enjoyed it. So I really saw my parents building themselves from zero. And actually, it was minus. It was below that because they had debt into a family that could provide for us. And they paid for my university education. And I was very grateful for that. So that marked me deeply. Mm-hmm. But then the other side is also my passion for things. And of course, with this story, I've always seen myself as one day I want to prove myself as well. And I want to show them that I've learned enough from them and I can build something too. But then the other thing was, but what do I really want to build, right? And with time, I realized what is the definition of success for me. What does it mean to make an impact? And how much impact do I want to bring? And when it came to my personal challenges in life, and that's the second part of it, it's I have polycystic ovarian syndrome. Mm-hmm. It's very common. Depending on the statistics, 1 in 8 or 1 in 10 women mm-hmm. have it. Mm-hmm. And I realized that, I mean, people live with it all the mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. And there hasn't been a lot of research. There hasn't been a lot of funding in there. And when I went through these challenges with the NHS having very, very long waiting times, now it's around 18 weeks, all the way to health insurance not catering for a lot of the reproductive health conditions, I realized that there was a massive market there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's when I found my why. And that's why I started building Juniper.
Okay, wow. And thanks for sharing that personal kind of connect, why you are where you are currently. And it really sounds that entrepreneurship is really deeply rooted in you, right? So it started really off at a very young age and you got inspired by your parents. Yeah? Yeah. And that still makes you keep going, it sounds like. And probably picking on that, as someone who has actually navigated multiple cultures, starting from your Italian-Chinese heritage to your also professional journey here in the UK, how have these diverse experiences that you shared really shaped your perspective as a leader and also as an innovator, especially in the healthcare insurance industry, which is a very special sector, of course?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I had the privilege to be exposed to so many cultures, so many different schools of thought as mm-hmm. well. And I think what my main takeaway from it was is everyone will have their own opinions and all of their opinions are rooted in very, very deep beliefs. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do as leaders, oftentimes understanding these beliefs and going one step further and really put yourself into someone else's shoes all the time and be able to have that versatility always. Mm-hmm. And that's why I learned when I lived in China 5 years ago. That's what I learned living in the UK. Mm-hmm. I mean, the British culture is a hard one to crack, but when you really sit down with them, you understand how they think and you understand why mm-hmm. the milk is in the tea, you know? So there's a lot of richness in that. But the best thing that I had from navigating different experiences was that diversity of thoughts and being able to appreciate it. And at the same time, having had different experiences in different industries as well, you understand the why behind everything. Mm-hmm. And the appreciation of it actually leads to a much bigger picture oftentimes.
And with your background that you also gathered before founding Juniper, you absolutely have obviously a background in private equity, but also in investment banking, as mentioned before. And of course, these are high pressure, deal oriented environments, often coming with intense working hours, as we know. What were for you the most valuable lessons that you've learned through working in these atmospheres, situations, and which of those habits or skills have you carried over into being now a founder and a CEO of Juniper?
I mean, investment banking and private equity were really the MBA of life for me. It was wonderful. And as you said, it's very long hours, but I'm very grateful for that experience. And the lessons I take away with me, I cherish every single day. Of course, I'm very happy to be building Juniper. But, you know, one of the main things is the discipline and the resilience that you build in these industries mm-hmm. where you have such high pressure. The deliverables are always on your back. Mm-hmm. But you learn how to cope with stress. You learn perfection under stress as well. But you also understand how much you can push your own limits from mm-hmm. a productivity perspective. Mm-hmm. So I've been very inspired by people in the industry. I still keep in touch with them. And a lot of them have also gone on to build wonderful businesses. But I think there are a few things that I always do. from a practicality perspective that I've been taught in investment banking and private equity. One, which is I always take a notebook with me. Mm-hmm. I take notes wherever I go. That's my way of absorbing information.
There's handwritten, as I see, right?
Handwritten, yes.
Yeah. Plus one.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And for me, it's extremely important. I think we work in very fast-paced industries and you need to absorb information fast mm-hmm. and not let it go. And I had to become a sponge. Mm-hmm. And I carry that with me all the time. The other thing is that I always ask questions when I don't understand. Mm-hmm. Because the number one rule in banking, in private equity, if you want to be a high performer, is you have X number of weeks where you can ask questions, all the dumb questions in the world, and then you can never ask them again.
Yep. So then you're the expert. Huh?
Yes, exactly. So I ask every question always when I don't understand it, whether it's actually with some of our colleagues and they say some British words and I don't understand them, all the way to insurance terminology, to medical terminology, anything. That's mm-hmm. how we learn. And maybe the last thing is, and this is private equity that gave me a big, big lesson there, is structuring thoughts and frameworks. Mm-hmm. As an investor, you need to look at the bigger picture. And how do you question the bigger picture is very important. So do you have a good list of things that you can always look at? Whether it's how big is the market? What are the market trends? How does this business model works? These are the metrics you need to look at, all the way to certain details. And this gives me a better picture in building a business, going into the detail all the way to looking at the roadmap of what Juniper is.
In a way, it sounds a lot of similarities also to consulting, of course.
Yeah, absolutely,
like the discipline, yeah. Resilience, coping with stress and still delivering the 100% solution. So yeah. There is similarities. Probably jumping into the business that you're currently building yourself, right? In the UK, there is 1 in 3 women that are suffering from reproductive or gynecological issues. And 1 in 4 men do experience also low testosterone by the age of 30. Most of insurances, however, exclude coverage for such chronic or pre-existing conditions, placing also the burden of treatment costs on the very individuals. Juniper, from what I understand, aims to revolutionize health insurance by filling this gap in coverage for reproductive health, which is including treatments for endometriosis or menopause, but also medical checkups for low testosterone or prostate screening, focusing on medium to large enterprises. You offer tailored insurance packages for their employees through employee benefits brokers. You have yourself also compared when checking kind of your website and what you do and what you announce, your approach to be similar to a dental insurance, supporting discovery or routine consultations and also treatments, of course. However, dental insurance still is so much more common than reproductive insurance, as we know it today, at least. Yeah. So why do you think is that? And what significance should reproductive health actually have, given that it often affects how we feel, impacting our energy levels throughout the day, but also our mental health?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's great, the statistics that you mentioned up front, right? 1 in 3 women suffer from reproductive health or gynecological issues. Yeah. 1 in 4 men experience low testosterone. So we see the breadth of the issue. And you mentioned dental insurance. Mm-hmm. We all have teeth. Most of us have gone for a dental checkup. Some didn't. But the difference is that teeth are not a taboo. Everyone mm-hmm. has them. We smile. We look at them. People are getting veneers nowadays. But, you know, at work, you would say, I am going to the dentist today.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't say, I am going to the gynecologist or I am going to the urologist. And so we're seeing reproductive organs, the intimate parts of you, being such a big taboo. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't say until actually a few years ago that you have menopause in the workforce. Now mm-hmm. it's becoming more and more common. But one thing that we need to think about is also in the UK, 1 in 10 people will have tooth issues. They will mm-hmm. have fillings, crowns. 1 in 5 people will have gum diseases, mm-hmm. right? And that's why we need dental insurance. Yeah. But when we look at the world of reproductive health, 1 in 10 women have endometriosis. 1 in 3 women are going through menopause, looking at the whole population. So actually, the majority of women will go through menopause mm-hmm. at some point, right? And when you look at the male side of things, we spoke about low testosterone levels over the age of 45. We spoke about prostate cancer earlier as well. So 1 in 8 men will suffer from prostate cancer. So we're talking about very, very staggering statistics here. And the issue is that reproductive health has been a taboo, very simply. Health insurance back in time wasn't really a benefit in the workforce. It became a benefit and now it's become a core benefit. Everyone has it. Everyone needs it. But reproductive issues have always been personal. It's been your personal life at home and you never bring it to work. And now it's becoming, it's impacting people more and more. Family planning issues are impacting your productivity in the workforce. I mean, there's staggering statistics here. When it comes to infertility, 63% of people struggle to focus in the workforce because of it.
63%?
63% of people that are going through family planning issues. There are 40 million days lost in the UK per year because of menopause. But we're also seeing an older generation in the workforce. People are working for longer. And so we need to bear in mind what people need to keep themselves in the workforce. So it heavily affects your mental health. It heavily affects your personal health, your personal lifestyle, actually. And when it comes to things like low testosterone, it affects, it actually translates into mood swings. It translates into erectile dysfunction, irritability. And it's actually very similar symptoms to menopause. But if you think of a man that is suffering from low testosterone and is having erectile dysfunction, that impacts your body confidence as well. And it translates into a lower productivity at work. And we're looking at statistics around 10 to 20% of lower productivity at work.
So in a way, in order to overcome this, it needs a bit of a de-tabooing, to get rid of taboos around around this area, to make it more similar to seeing a dentist if you go to see a gynecologist, for instance. I mean, having you here, I'm intrigued to also probe a bit into kind of gender differences in healthcare. And despite obviously significant progress towards closing that gender health gap in recent years, if you ask me, there is still much work to be done. And in your experience on the ground that you have, what are the most significant kind of misconceptions about the needs, but also the priorities of, in that case, women's health, that the healthcare industry must address going forward?
Yeah, there are a lot of misconceptions, but I think there are maybe three main ones that we need to look at. And we need to also appreciate that there's been a lot of progress. But on women's health specifically, one of the misconceptions is that one size fits all. But actually, reproductive health is very complex and it changes from the moment you go into your reproductive years all the way to when you die, essentially. You go through a series of diseases or conditions that can be very different. So we need to recognize that diversity and we need to recognize that you need a lot of specialism in the space within women's health. You will not most likely have the same gynecologist your whole life. Right. The second piece is education. So we have seen decades and decades now of women saying, I am going through a lot of pain right now during my menstrual period, or I am feeling like this, I'm feeling like that. And the feedback oftentimes is, this is normal. You just need to deal with it. That's just period pain. But it isn't. And so we're seeing nowadays, actually, people that thought they were just life issues from a lifestyle perspective, they're actually conditions and we can treat them. So we need to push that agenda forward in making sure that we are not over-diagnosing, but we are not under-diagnosing either. And maybe the third bit is, it's not just about education in women's health. It's not just about awareness, but the main thing after having the education on women's health and understanding it is, how can I actually cater for it? And cost is a massive barrier. Because on one side, if you do have public healthcare systems in certain countries, reproductive health is not a life-threatening condition oftentimes. So you have very, very long waiting times. And on the other side, a lot of reproductive health conditions are either chronic, 80% of them are chronic or asymptomatic. So your health insurance won't cover it. So how can we afford the care for women's health? That's a big question now.
And as we are in the UK here with the NHS, is teeth health, in a way, is that funded by the NHS, or is that also coming on top of your normal NHS insurance?
It's a hybrid.
It's a hybrid.
Yeah, dental is hybrid in the UK. It's partially subsidized by the NHS and you need to pay yourself and there are long waiting times, or you go private, and the majority of people go private.
Okay.
For dental. So dental insurance is very helpful there. And we're seeing a similar trend with reproductive health. That's a reality, because the NHS can't take on board all of this demand. They cannot do diagnostic tests because you want to, right? Although we should have preventative care every single year. And so how can we fund it is the big question. And this is why, for us, insurance is the key to it. Mm-hmm. We are building the first insurance product here that can actually cater for reproductive health and can help you pay for the care that you need.
And you build it as a B2B business, if I recall correct, right? So you kind of go to big, small, whatever sized employers, and they offer the employee benefits through giving access to your program.
Right? Exactly. The same way you have health insurance at work, you can have a gym membership, you should be able to have reproductive health. We're seeing more and more companies also paying themselves for IVF treatments for their employees, but they're essentially self-insuring. Because they realize there's no insurance product in the market. They keep asking to their insurance broker and they keep saying, look, we can't cover it. So the companies are doing it themselves. And that's the gap that we fill for the employee. But also, we help the insurance industry boost their diversification as well, because they've never covered this book of business before.
And probably jumping quickly back still to the gender gap that we're having. We talked about women's health and priorities in this. At the same time, also men have their package to carry, because men disproportionately avoid medical checkups and more often do not regularly visit their urologists. And unlike women, actually, who usually begin to regularly see their gynecologist from a very very young age onwards, actually. Initiatives, of course, like Movember aims to raise much more awareness on men's health, such as prostate cancer and others. And despite this, there has not been really a turnaround in male doctoral visits that we can actually see. What could be, from your perspective, additional solutions to close this, let's call it kind of the opposite gender health gap?
Yeah. Well, it's very fair, because we do see that there's more stigma for men than there is for women nowadays.
Yes.
Men are just very shy to talk about it oftentimes. It's very intimate. I don't think there's a lot of men that would go to work and tell their work colleague, look, I have erectile dysfunction. However, with Juniper, what we've seen is that the first companies that we onboarded, and we've looked at the claims that has come through, and the first ones that came through were actually men going for a checkup. So it's interesting, because men don't talk about it, but the moment you're giving them the tools, they will have it. They will do it. So the number one thing for us to change this opposite gender health gap, and for me, it's actually bringing a solution that covers both genders, equalizes them. And it's not about equality. It's about equity. Because we have very, very different bodies, we have different health statuses, we have different age groups as well. So it's about giving them all different tools for their different needs, but equalize that and say, look, both men and women have it and you should all go for a checkup. So by giving this in the workplace, it really has helped in the companies that we serve from a preventative perspective. The second thing is, of course, workplace initiatives and education. We're seeing a slower take up for men in attendance to webinars. But at some point, when there is a word of mouth, when there is the right marketing, it works really well. Men do start speaking about it. But you need to make it cool, essentially. You need to make it not awkward. And the third one is really, let's address that men's stigma, right? Let's talk about it very openly. Because that's how you get the elephant out of the room right away. If I am the first person to talk about erectile dysfunction, then people will not feel awkward around me.
Yeah. You intrigue me now, because you talked about cool topics, right? You need to make it cool. Also, part of your coverage is educational elements.
Yeah? It is.
And those webinars or get-togethers that you're having with your members, so to say. I mean, how do you make such a topic kind of Cool. Untabooing it, and how do you present it then?
Yeah. Well, one thing is that we are not care providers of ourselves, mm-hmm. but we are care facilitators. So we partner with a lot of people. We partner with doctors. We partner with clinics, and we give them the tools to share their voice, really. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of doctors that share their own experiences, some that have different styles. Mm-hmm. And that's how we populate our educational hub. Mm-hmm. But what works really well there is also we look at what people ask mm-hmm. through our support chats, through different requests. And based on that, we develop other content. Because if someone is asking for it, it means that someone else is also thinking about it. And that way, we promote a free-flowing list of information that continues, and we keep building on that. Mm-hmm. But we are also not outdated. One thing that is also extremely important is that not everyone will ask questions. Mm-hmm. So how can you keep them informed? There are people who are more proactive and they will book a consultation right away. And there are people who are more reactive and they will never make a claim. So can you provide educational content that is up to date for them? That's how we do it. Mm-hmm. By looking at what other people ask, and we provide that in writing through blogs and articles that are fully vetted by clinicians.
And there must be differences in age, sex, and other Absolutely. Confounding factors, making people do a claim, get on to educational elements and not. Is there any kind of tendency that you're seeing the younger, the more women or whatever, the more questions yeah. will be asked? Or is there any pattern?
We've seen the younger generations to be much more focused on preventative care.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay.
They are more health aware.
Uh-huh.
And then you have a gap, and then it starts the fertility checkups oftentimes. And then there's a little pause, unless there are some people that will always go for checkups, always. And then you start with all of the conditions that come with later ages. So aging conditions like mm-hmm. menopause. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing actually the younger generation wanting the full checkup, including your testosterone levels, including your STI checkup, all of it's all packaged together. And they want to do that once a year because it's covered by your company. So why not?
Cool. In a recent article for the InsurTech magazine, you also shared that Uniper's insurance model not only covers treatment, but also does emphasize preventative care, as you also outlined just now, and also routine checkups around reproductive health. How do you see this focus that you're bringing on preventative care also impacting the overall healthcare outcomes for your insured members?
Look, it's massive. For us, this is really the core of our business. Mm-hmm. And the insurance industry thinks we're crazy because they never want to invest in preventative care. Mm-hmm. That's a big investment upfront for an ROI that's not certain for them because they've never done it in insurance. But for us, we understand reproductive health inside out. And we understand that the earlier you know something, the cheaper it becomes to treat it oftentimes. Mm-hmm. So if you think of, let's take a very simple example, right? Prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. 1 in 8 men have prostate cancer. The majority of men actually die with prostate cancer, not because of it, but with. If you diagnose it in stage 1, the treatment costs are going to be very different from diagnosing in stage 4 when you start having symptoms. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those cancers that doesn't really show symptoms until later on. Or let's take the other example on the woman's side of, ovarian cysts. You can have ovarian cysts that are very small and you just monitor it, or you can have a massive ovarian cyst that bursts and then it's actually life-threatening. Mm-hmm. So why don't you get that checkup and make sure that you're fine? The same way with teeth, if you have a cavity and it goes down to your nerve, it hurts like hell. But if you do your yearly checkup, then it will never go that far. You will never lose that tooth, right? And same goes in fertility here. So if you can do a fertility assessment early on and you know you're educated about what your ovarian reserve looks like, what your sperm levels look like, then you will make more informed decisions also in your life. And whether it's also related to your career, it's related to your partner, rather than arriving at the late 30s and realize, actually, I am really struggling here. Mm. And there's no going back. I haven't frozen my eggs. I haven't frozen my sperm. There's no way around it. Mm. So that's why we heavily focus on prevention, and it really impacts your quality of life at the end and your outcomes in life.
I mean, you hit a very important point, because we, at least in the Western world, we are living in a sick care environment, of course, right? So
yes.
the more diagnostics, the more drugs, the more operational procedures, the more kind of money flows to whoever does it. And now pivoting into preventative care, obviously, there is always that question around what is the return on invest that I'm doing today?
Yeah.
And there is obviously fair questions around it. Because if you get a CAR T cell therapy that costs you a couple of hundred thousand, yeah, up to a million or two, you're getting this today and tomorrow you get a heart attack or you get into an accident and you die. So what's the return on that invest is always a fair question.
Yeah.
I mean, how does the system, so to say, other health insurances, but also doctors, do react to what you're doing?
It's an interesting question. The insurers are very different from doctors. So the doctors, as you said, they want to make money. Of course, a lot of them, they are there to, they pledged to save people's lives. But it's also a massive industry. There's a lot of money going behind it, especially fertility nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So we are there to strike that balance between what is too much, right? We are there, we're financing things, but we'll finance them until what we think is right.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, if that patient wants, they will pay out of pocket if they really want to follow on with certain things with that doctor. But we also work with our medical board and we make sure that we vet every clinic that we work with. And we sit down with them and we ask them questions and we have a clinical framework, clinical governance framework around it. On the insurer side, it's the opposite. The insurer doesn't want to spend money. I mean, as brutal as it sounds, it's cheaper for them if you get diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and you die, then to actually fund the whole treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So what we are telling them is that you need to come in very, very early on and solve the problem fast. There will be some things that will be recurring, and that's fine, but you will not incur those high, high costs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very different shift in mindset. And we're seeing some health insurers are including things like GP services themselves because they realize the importance of tackling some things early. But they're still walking on eggshells. They are still unsure about which position they want to take, whether it's fully preventative or not at all.
Got it. And I mean, it's in the end, you have an innovative product, right? So you must have also experienced and are experiencing manifold of challenges when designing, but also launching such a specialized insurance offering like reproductive health insurance as you do. Can you probably elaborate around the hurdles that you had to overcome, but also still have to tackle as challenges today in order to meet kind of the unique requirements and needs of your customers in the end?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, one of the first challenges was definitely the fact that reproductive health has a stigma around it, but also that's always linked to fertility and reproduction. And so we always thought, well, I mean, reproductive organs is the right word for it, but it's not conveying the right message.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we go around it? And that was a marketing play. And that's how we started branding ourselves. It's like dental insurance for your genitals. And it worked really, really well. Some investors, I mean, they loved it. And when we say, oh, we're Juniper, they're like, oh, yeah, you are the genitals insurance company. And they giggle. And, you know, there's no such thing as bad marketing, but marketing is always very good marketing as well. It was a bit harder on the insurance side, for sure. So we raised funds. We raised 1.5 million pre-seed, and definitely that tagline helped. On the insurer side, when you walk into a room full of men, and you talk about reproductive issues, it's hard.
Uh-huh.
And we spent a lot of time trying to understand what was the right tone. And we realized, well, there isn't one. We just need to shock them. And look, either they're going to have a laugh or they won't. So that worked at some point. But the other issue was a lot of people then understood it. And they were like, but why hasn't this done before, right? Like, it's so simple. There's such a big problem. We just need it. So why is it you that you are building it and no one else? And that was battling against the complexity of the product. Because if something was easy, everyone would be doing it. And the reality is that reproductive health is complex. Insurance is even more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And putting the two things together was an impossible challenge for a lot of people. And so coming with my background in financial services and coming with my own PCOS experience, I made it my own mission to do this. So it was difficult to explain why others hadn't done it. But when you did, then people would understand.
So surely reproductive health, where you're in, is not a UK-only topic, right? So I'm wondering, in other areas of the world, be it in the US or also other parts of Europe and Asia, it must also be an issue there. Yeah. Is there any kind of similarities? Is there any peers of yours that are kicking off businesses there as well already?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have genitals all over the world.
Absolutely.
So we definitely see this issue in many other places. The complexity of Juniper is that actually reproductive health is different country to country from what the healthcare actually provides in each country. But there's also a cultural element to it. So we would be able to come into different legislations, different countries, different regulations, and be able to cater for each one of them. Mm-hmm. And what's really happening now is we're seeing big, big players called Maven, Carrot, Progyny in the US. And they are fertility benefits managers. They go to companies and say, look, we'll manage your fertility benefits and we'll send your people to family planning clinics. But they are essentially a third-party administrator. They tell you where to go and then they ask the insurer or they ask the company to pay for it and then they reimburse you. But what we are, to me, the second generation of these companies. We come in and we actually structure a very complex product, which is insurance, and we're the first ones to be able to pay for it. So we verticalize a little bit more into not just giving care, but actually paying for care. And so we are able to then give the same playing field to companies that want to have global benefits and say, look, if you are based in Singapore, you can still go for the same things based on your local legislations and regulations. If you are an employee in Texas versus Massachusetts, we'll try our best to give you the same benefits, even if the states don't allow you to do so.
It's hard these days to do a podcast without touching at least some of the technology, right? And lately, we also have been talking to the CTO of Boehringer Ingelheim, Clemens Utschik, around the power of quantum computing in pharma, or also Bijoy Sagar, who is the CTO of Bayer, talking about machine learning and AI and the like. I mean, in what ways do you see those emerging technologies like AI, like machine learning, transforming the somewhat traditional healthcare insurance landscape? And additionally, probably also, what are some of the most promising innovations that are currently being developed in the insurtech space that, yeah, you would say you are most excited by?
Yeah. I mean, we see AI very often. There's a lot of buzz around it. I think the insurance industry is excited yet scared because, as you said, it's a long-standing industry. There's a lot of best practices that haven't changed over time. Not necessarily because they should change, but some perhaps should. In what we see, AI has a massive impact when it comes to risk modeling. So what used to be the normal pricing with actuaries behind it, now you can create actually models that are trained to have predictive analytics, but also really go deep into what large language models can help with there. So can we actually improve, quote unquote, diagnostics of certain health outcomes earlier on? A lot of the pricing nowadays in health insurance are based on historical claims data. So based on historical claims data, that's the price for next year. That is inherently wrong. When it comes to health, there is first medical inflation and second research changes, right? So when it comes to reproductive health, we can't at all just rely ourselves on historical data. We need to be able to predict it. Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing in insurance is underwriting. There was a paper that came out saying that in 2030, underwriting as we know it today won't exist anymore because we will be able to leverage machine learning and deep learning as well behind it. And so I'm very excited to see how we can integrate these technologies ourselves into the business, because the dream is to create a very, very lean business that can operate on efficiencies. And that's the opposite of what insurance means oftentimes. But what we're also seeing is that the insurance industry will be impacted in very, very different ways in the pockets of values that it has. You're looking at the supply chain that's going from claims to underwriting to pricing. There's marketing as well. And they work all differently. So how can AI actually empower that is exciting. But what is the most exciting thing is to understand how the regulators will react to it. Because nowadays, we're seeing all of these risk models that are supported by AI, they actually need to have full transparency in front of the regulators. So we need to make sure that these technologies are not used as a black box, but can we translate them in a way that not just we can understand, but also the regulators. And that's important. That's not just to be painful. That's actually, let's double check the work. Let's make sure that we are being compliant, right? And so insurance is clunky. Healthcare is clunky. Let's see how we can revolutionize the two together. We are doing a bit of it in the early stages, but we're seeing a lot of startups going to the space, going to Series B, Series C, with great pricing engines, with great underwriting engines. So there's a lot of excitement around it.
So fast forwarding, cutting through the kind of the clunkiness, as you put it. If we were to meet in 5 years from now, what would you call a success for your rather still young company, Uniper, of course? What would be this?
Yeah, I mean, the dream in 5 years is to be able to really cater for reproductive health everywhere, be able to finance it for people. So our motto is that we want to help people afford the best care possible. And that's North Star for us. So are we going to be able to do that by issuing our insurance policies? And we are hopefully doing that very, very soon, the first policy of this kind ever. Can we sell into global companies? We're currently piloting internationally as well. So are we able to replicate the business model elsewhere? And are we able to be really the leaders in reproductive health from a knowledge perspective, country by country, and really be that traffic light coordinator everywhere?
Well, I mean, a great picture to end with, I guess, right? And really, thanks, Ambra. Thanks for taking us along your personal kind of life journey, beginning at a very young age where you've been kind of supporting your parents, running around the restaurant, all the way through to now founding Juniper as a proper startup here. Thanks for sharing your passion and the experiences around reproductive health. And yeah, I can only state that wishing you all the very best, obviously, for the coming years, and let it grow and cut through the clunkiness.
Thank you so much.
So I really hope that you again enjoyed the conversation with Ambra on reproductive health as much as I did. Please do not forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. We really appreciate your support and look very much forward to bringing you more thought-provoking episodes in the very near future. Until then, stay safe and tune in next time.
Strategy made real.